No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or Skype us at BBS Radio 1. We have a special guest with us tonight, Jean-Michel Gérard. Jean-Michel is the executive director of Friendship Place in Washington, D.C. He has used his 25 years of training and experience to pioneer innovative programs that have moved D.C.'s entire homeless service system forward. He was named to the D.C. Interagency Council on Homelessness and has sat on the board of the Coalition of Housing and Homeless Organizations. He also authors a blog on the Huffington Post and is the recipient of the Meyer Foundation Exponent Award for Visionary Nonprofit Leadership. He is with us tonight to discuss homelessness in the District of Columbia and how we can combat it. This is an ever-growing serious problem in our community and across America, and we want to know what you think. So please call in at 888-628-6008 or Skype us with your questions. Before I go any further, let me introduce my co-host, Kathleen, who I hear mumbling in the background there.
I'm sorry.
Back in Arizona this week. Wait a second. I don't want to start any trouble here, but I can't help noticing that you went to Kansas and they lost to Wichita State, and then you went to Arizona and they lost to Wisconsin. You're kind of like the Typhoid Mary of college basketball.
No,
what's
let
going
me tell
on?
You something. They choked.
Maybe you should get down to North Carolina quick while Gonzaga still has a chance.
Listen. They choked. They lost to Wisconsin last year. It's been something that they've had a hard time, you know, beating Wisconsin. So everyone was kind of wondering if they were going to win anyway. You know, so I don't think it's my fault, quite frankly. Nothing is my fault.
And I didn't want to point this out, but now that you've pushed the issue, when you were here in Washington, my alma mater, the University of Maryland, lost as well.
Geez. Well, you know what's sad? What's sad in America is how we always have to blame somebody, right? We can't take responsibility for our own actions. We have to sit there and blame somebody else. So if that makes you feel better, Senator Brown, then you go ahead and blame me. I'm used to it.
All right. It does make me feel better.
So anyway, I was just talking. We'll be having Jean-Michel, they should be calling him any time now. It's always amazing with technology. You know, you get so far in technology, and it opens so many doors at the same time. It always makes it difficult to open the doors.
Yeah, because you and I don't have the key. That's the problem.
Exactly.
We lack the key. We're just knocking on the door hoping somebody answers.
Well, listen, is he on? Do we have Jean-Michel on? Not yet.
I'm here.
Oh, there he is.
Jean-Michel, welcome. But before we introduce him, I got to say one thing about those rotten Republicans beating up the District of Columbia this week. They're at it again on Capitol Hill. Senator Cruz of Texas and Lankford of Oklahoma, both Republicans, of course, are trying to strike down two D.C. laws that they say violate religious freedom. They're right in there with the governor of Indiana. One targets reproductive health for poor women, and the other deals with non-discrimination and employment for gay people. Both these laws were passed by the District of Columbia Council, and now these guys are trying to interfere with them. So boo on you, Senator Cruz and Senator Lankford. And now, Kathleen, please introduce our guest. I had to get that off my chest.
You had to get off your chest. Well, again, we're very excited for our audience to talk to Jean-Michel, because you are doing something that's so important, and it's not only in D.C., but across America. Tucson, they have a huge problem with homelessness. But we, here he is, Jean-Michel. Can you explain to us what Friendship Place does? What's so unique about your program?
Yes, well, Friendship Place is a homeless services organization empowering individuals and families to rebuild their lives through housing and employment, and utilizing community strength to do that. We have a wonderful following in Upper Northwest and now in the region, helping us reach out to our neighbors who are on the brink of homelessness or already homeless with some really terrific permanent solutions for a lasting impact on homelessness. We are working to end homelessness in D.C. and in the region. And by that, we mean that we are building systems strong enough to significantly reduce the period of homelessness when it does happen still, so that people are back into housing with jobs as quickly as we can.
Well, you know, I have to say that I went and visited with Jean-Michel and his staff a few weeks ago, and I got to tell you, I was just so impressed at your operation. First of all, I used to give out blankets at downtown at the main shelter downtown, and I worked in a soup kitchen for 10 years. I have never been in homeless facilities that were as clean and well-staffed and well-organized as yours, Jean-Michel. I mean, it was such an impressive tour that I got of two little facilities. I was just amazed at how upbeat everybody was, how engaged the staff was, like you say, how clean it was, and how you seemed to be helping so many people. So before we even start, I'd like to say just how impressed I am with your operation. But can we talk for a second about how large the problem is in the District of Columbia, what the numbers are, how many homeless people, is it growing? Are we doing anything to stem the problem?
Well, yes, and first of all, thank you for the very kind words, and we were delighted to have you with us when you came over. Well, unfortunately, as we all know, because we read the press or watch television, the problem is growing in the district. Last year, homelessness grew by 13%. We counted 7,748 homeless people in the district. And particularly on the family side, where actually that number went up by 20%. So this is a count that's already old. It's about 14 months old. It was done in January of 2014. But we are estimating that this year's count, and that report will come out in May, will be even higher. So we have to be prepared to really address the issues, particularly on the family side. And I have to say that I'm very much encouraged by what I'm seeing in the district. The mayor is really championing the cause. She has put in place folks at the head of DHS. The Department of Human Services, Laura Zeilinger, is back working in the district. Deborah Carroll at Department of Employment Services. Polly Donaldson. And she's retained Christy Greenwald as the executive director of the D.C. Interagency Council on Homelessness. And so I think there are some clear signs, besides the fact that the mayor is talking in meetings a lot about this, that she is determined to rein in the the issue and to do something about it. When we talk about, you know, 7,700 people homeless, you really have to add at least about 50% to that count. This is a one-day count. So we went over the 10,000 people mark last year. In the region, we estimate the count was around 12,000. We estimate that some people put the total estimate around 19,000, 20,000. You sometimes hear a figure of 30,000. And there again, the mayor, I think, is doing something very innovative in that she is entering into an agreement with Prince George's County and Montgomery County that was just released recently, so that we can finally take a look at the issue as a region and start to do that. I think that's really important.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's been a problem all along, is that we haven't looked at this problem regionally. And that's the, you know, the, we have the regional statistics through the Council of Governments, but we don't have any regional agreements. Let me ask you one quick thing before Kathleen gets to ask you a question, because you said the increase in family homelessness. I used to work at DC Village. I used to volunteer at DC Village, which was just the most terrible place that I'd ever been in my entire life, for where children actually were. But they finally closed it down. Is that part of our problem? They were going to replace that with smaller shelters, but they closed DC Village, I don't know, 5, 7, 8 years ago. Has that been part of the problem with families?
Well, the problem with families is that is affordability. We have a definite shortage of affordable housing in the district, and more pressure is put on that market with all the folks moving into the district who can afford to pay for higher cost rentals. So the very poor families who are in need of housing are falling through the cracks and need our assistance. We closed DC Village, as you know, because it was an inadequate facility, and people came to a realization that we had to do this. We then sheltered the families at DC General, and that facility is not adequate either. So it's time, and we're looking at that at the Interagency Council on Homelessness. I'm a member of the council. We're going to release a plan this week, and I can't go into details of the plan because it has yet to be approved. But the plan is going to look at some very specific issues. It's going to look at reducing the period families spend in shelter, and it's going to look at gradually moving the funding towards permanent supportive housing. It's going to look at a number of other issues. And I think that in the end, employment will also be very important. And as you know, at Friendship Place, we have Aim Higher, our job placement and rehousing program that uses an employment-first approach. I think that's key, and we are hoping that the district will move forward and switch to employment-first. By employment-first, we mean that we assume employability in everybody. We look for the skill set. And then with some soft skill training that's very quick, we focus on job placement. And at Aim Higher, we average 60 days for job placement. And then for rapid rehousing and prevention, with a one-month subsidy to the landlord, all of this privately funded, we get people either stabilized in housing who were about to be evicted, or rehoused in 90 days. So we're hoping that this new approach, and we are not the only ones using it in the country, other groups are, but we're hoping that the district will adopt this new approach so that we can really put people into jobs more quickly.
So then your plan is to actually put people, find them a job, and then within 90 days, get them a housing?
Exactly. So when you think about it, because Aim Higher is a privately funded program, these folks are bypassing the public system altogether, and they really just need a hand off. and they know that. And I think the model is especially empowering because we recognize that these folks don't need long-term subsidies, don't need assistance that lasts months or years. They just need a little bit of assistance. And the message from the folks we have served there is the same as the message that from the folks we are serving in our supportive services program for veterans' families, that it feels great to know that we as a system know that they only need that little bit of assistance.
Well, I think that's very true, and it's amazing. As I left D.C. in the 80s, and come back, and I'm just astonished by the rents. So I guess the council, the Council of Government, according to the Council of Governments, the district has lost over 36,000 low-cost rental housing between 2000 and 2010. And I know when I'm going in, I was looking for a two-bedroom for me and my son, and, I'm looking at $3,000, and there's not much, it's not really like $3,000 you would think would really get you something. We're talking still about very small places with no green space. So, does the loss of all the low-cost rental housing, I would assume that that's part of the problem, because since I came back to D.C., I'm shocked by the development across all the, all of D.C., even in Anacostia. And I guess as they built and developed, they didn't, and took over those areas that are very low-cost rentals where people didn't want to live, they haven't replaced them with thing. So, I'm just amazed just trying to come in there. You really have to be making big money to be able to just move into D.C. without any problem.
And that's right, and it's something that we need to look at as a system, to find new solutions so that we can have workforce housing for the folks who need to live in the city, have lived in the city for generations for some of them, and so that going forward we can have these folks stay in the city.
Well, since Kathleen brought this up, I have a very specific problem, and I don't know what the solution to this problem is, but maybe you know how we can help. I have a couple of ideas, but I don't know if they're viable. In the next 5 years, we're going to lose 45 multi-unit affordable housing complexes, which are going to be converted to market price rent. And the reason that this is going to happen is because they got government loans, subsidized loans that were good for 15 years if they kept their units at subsidized, at low rates. But now the 15 years is expiring, and these 45 multi-unit complexes, which represent thousands of units of affordable housing, are about to go to market rent. Now, I think that the government should offer them extensions on the loan, offer the landlords that are interested in some sort of additional incentive, or they should provide some sort of voucher system for people that are there to mitigate the impact of the increased rents. What do you think we can do to deal with this problem? Because this is going to be a problem in the next 5 years.
Well, it's very hard to go against the market, of course, because, the real estate prices have gone up and the market is going in that direction. But as much as possible, yes, I think we need to really work on salvaging what we have and add to the pool, because going forward, this is going to be more and more of an issue. We know the population is growing in the district, as I mentioned earlier, and the folks coming in do have the means to rent on the open market. So going forward, I think it's going to take a real community effort, and people who are in decision-making roles, I think, need to look at this very seriously, and I think many are in that group, so that we can have a city that's fair and where people can afford to live who don't make a lot of money.
Well, that's very true. I'm sorry. I just wanted to follow up with that. Sometimes it seems that, you know, like New York has always had this problem. It's just getting worse. And I saw where in New York that the mayor is actually offering some kind of tax break to, you know, like I think the city is going to pay them actually a couple of months' rent. Now, is that something you guys are thinking of too? I mean, well, let me get it this way. If I'm somebody who's homeless, where would I go to find your program? I mean, are you able to seek these people out, I guess, at the homeless shelters? Or do you have a mechanism where you're getting to people before they become homeless?
Well, I think it's really important to look at what we call prevention, homelessness prevention. So to start working with people while they're still in place, if that's a possibility, is absolutely key for families. It means that the children will avoid the trauma of eviction, of losing their homes, the destabilization in terms of, you know, trying to get to school in the morning and ending up in large sites like DC General, where, you know, there are a number of issues we know about. And for singles, it's also key because if the person does not have to lose their living situation, I think we've already accomplished something that's very important. And I'm saying that because the literature in the field has often said, and it's true, that you get more bang for your buck as a system if you focus on rehousing. And that's true, but I think that the prevention work really has its place. And at Friendship Place, in our direct housing program, which is privately funded and rehouses or prevents, and then at AIM Higher, where that kind of assistance is linked to job placement, we focus on both. And then we run now a rather large rapid rehousing program, Home Now, which is funded by the city for single adults. So these rapid solutions are very important because in a matter of weeks or months, you can help somebody move forward and rebuild their lives. And in terms of accessing our services, we have many points of entry now into our system at Friendship Place. People can go on our website, friendshipplace.org, and can just look up the different programs, get in touch with the directors. We all answer our own phone, and the access is immediate with us.
Well,
that's
something that I really think that we should point out. You've mentioned it a couple of times, but I don't know that our listeners are getting it, that a lot of the work that Jean-Michel and his organization does is privately funded. And that's one of the most amazing things as far as I'm concerned, that this isn't all about government money. This isn't all about throwing money at the problem. This is about finding creative solutions, and I think you guys are just doing an incredible job doing that. But could you explain to us a little bit about what rapid rehousing is? Because I know in Virginia, rapid rehousing has worked very well in some areas, but we haven't used it as much in Washington. Is that true?
Yes. Well, rapid rehousing is now being used for families and for single adults. And then before the city asked us to work with single adults in the district, we decided in 2013 that we should organize our own rapid rehousing program simply because we were seeing that people who could not go back to work for different reasons or people who had extremely low income needed assistance, and that they were in a period where if we intervened right away, we would avoid further destabilization, which is so important. If you can avoid having somebody go into chronic homelessness, you have you've accomplished something which is huge, because we know that with chronic homelessness comes this organization that goes way beyond what is experienced during the first weeks or months. So this is for us about greeting the person, seeing what the issue is, seeing what the goals should be with the person driving the process, so empowering the couple, the family, or the single person to plan, to rebuild their lives, to imagine what they need to do to go beyond and get rehoused, and then to very quickly look at different issues that are going on, solve those, some financial planning, and then right into housing, so assistance, contacting landlords, matching people with living situations that are good for them, that they like, that are sufficient for the household. And then offering the landlord some subsidy, rental subsidy, to sort of bridge the gap, because, of course, the folks we are meeting don't have the money it takes to get back into housing. And then at Direct Housing, we are able to help these folks with different things that are going on as well. And by offering, you know, to usher somebody in with the landlord, we can make the whole difference, because it's really difficult if you're on the street or in shelter to convince a landlord not only to show you a unit, but that they should rent to you. But when there is a whole organization, a whole community like Friendship Place behind you, then you're perceived in a very different light. The landlord knows that if there is an issue in the future, there's a whole team that can activate to help solve the issue quickly, and that we are backing this person. So I think what we're really seeing beyond the rapid rehousing model is that the strength of a community behind people makes a whole difference.
I'd just like to make a statement too, that I think it is an ever-growing problem, because, you know, there's so many of us, and I mean so many people that I know that I always say, you know, I'm check to check. So, you know, living check, one check to the next paycheck. And when something happens, you know, you don't have the funds to, if you get sick or somebody dies or whatever the situation is, it's very easy to be homeless in America. It's not the kind of thing where it's just for the completely poor, the people who aren't educated. I see more and more middle class people, families, you know, losing their housing, and for many purposes, you know, the real estate market, the foreclosures that happen, or whatever, the economy. So it's a very serious issue that we should all be involved in, because I really do feel, especially with older Americans too, who get laid off, maybe haven't found a job, and are looking at, it's impossible to meet their, you know, their payment. So it's a very serious issue, and it sounds like it's something that might be able to help us.
And do we keep track of these people? I mean, Kathleen makes a good point. I remember Jean-Michel, a case where a homeless man died. He used to live under the Whitehorse Freeway. You know, I've seen him. I saw him there for years. People used to stop and try to help him when they could. But this was a man that fought a case before the Supreme Court. He was not, you know, he slipped into mental illness and lost his house and his family. And, you know, it was a long story in the Washington Post a few years ago. But do we keep track of who these people are and where they come from?
We do. We have an outreach team at Friendship Place that covers Upper Northwest. So we go inside Rock Creek Park to the Blanket site, all the way to the Potomac, and then from Western Avenue to Calvert Street. We have the largest outreach territory in the city, although it's not the most dense in terms of the population we see there. And it's really important to have your outreach workers be trained in mental health, be able to provide now for us some case management on the street, being able to solve issues as they go along and route people in the right direction. Of course, what we're also trying to do, and maybe primarily, is to build a trust relationship with people on the street so that they might come to see us at the drop-in center at 4713 Wisconsin Avenue, or at AIM Higher, which is across the street at 4652 Wisconsin. It's absolutely essential for the folks who go out to provide these services to know people by name, to know their histories when people share them, so that we can keep track of people, as you say, and help them the best way we can. There are issues on the street, and if you're on the street and isolated, you may not be able to get proper medical care if you have an emergency. So it's really important to cast a net over the neighborhoods where you outreach so that people feel that they're supported the right way. And the same is true, really, of community members all over Upper Northwest who know that they can call us at the office and that we will dispatch an outreach worker immediately if they're worried about somebody who is wearing a coat and it's 100 degrees outside, or doesn't have a coat and it's in the winter, somebody who may be spending time in their neighborhood. I think that the community response in Upper Northwest that we've been able to develop is really amazing and has become a model for communities out there pretty much all over the country.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that you are a model. And we'll do this again at the end of the show. But right now, why don't you give us either your website or your phone number where people, if people are out there and they're listening and they're in need or they know somebody that is in need, how do they get a hold of you, Jean-Michel?
Yes, so our phone number is 202-364-1419. So 364-1419. And for the website, it's friendshipplacedc.org.
And let me tell you, let me just put in this plug. We're going to take a little break, and we're going to take a few-minute break and play a song. But let me put in this plug. If you're doing your taxes and you want to make a charitable contribution, you know, you're inspired to make a charitable contribution to somebody, this is a great organization to make it tax deductible, right, Jean-Michel? You're tax deductible?
That's absolutely tax deductible, yes.
Right.
Thank you for this. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it won't save you from last year's taxes, but it'll save you for next year's taxes, and you should do it. I can't imagine you putting your money in any place that it would do more good than with these people. I've got to tell you, I was just so impressed, not only by Jean-Michel, but his entire staff, how enthusiastic they were, how much they help people in need. And it's just not, you know, it's not just about the government handing out more money. It's our community coming together to work through this wonderful organization. So we're going to take a break right now for a couple of minutes. We're going to play a song in honor of our guest, Jean-Michel, and the wonderful people at Friendship Place who have dedicated themselves to those less fortunate. So here's a song called Temporary Home by Carrie Underwood, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
Boy, 6 years old, a little too used to being alone. Another new mom and dad, another school, another house that'll never be home. When people ask him how.
And we're back. And thanks for that. And we're back here with Jean-Michel Gérard from Friendship Place in Washington, D.C., which is an incredibly progressive and unique organization helping homeless people. And I want to ask you, Jean-Michel, about D.C. General. the mayor has committed to close DC General Hospital in a year and go to models of smaller shelters. Those of you who may not be familiar with DC General is a big shelter in the District of Columbia. It's not very nice. It's not very family friendly. It's got a lot of problems, but people that are against closing it say it provides so much temporary shelter for families and for people in the district that it's hard to close it because you got to have something to replace it with. Last year there was a terrible tragedy where a young girl who had been missing for over a year now, Relisha Rudd, and is presumed dead, and she was at the shelter. So we really need to close it down, and the mayor's committed to that. But are we going to be able to do it, Jean-Michel?
Well, I believe we are, and I'm saying this because the mayor, again, seems to be very determined, and she wants to do something. She wants to find new solutions. And first of all, let me say how, you know, terrible, yes, this incident was, this loss possibly last year, and this you know, young girl who went missing. And, you know, this should never happen, of course, in a shelter. And I think that the whole DC community, the whole city, was really shocked by this, of course. And going forward, we need to find solutions. We need to find new ways to shelter people so that things like that can never happen again.
And I'm sorry.
Mayor wants a solution, and we have been in conversation with people from the Department of Human Services. As you've mentioned, they've come to see our models. Our models are small shelters. They're community-like. They are empowering. In the two shelters we run directly at Friendship Place St. Luke's and the Haven Shelter for Women, people get keys so that they can take second shift jobs and third shift jobs. They can sleep during the day if they have to. They do not have to exit the building in the morning and go into the elements if it's cold or too hot, so they can actually rest and get better medically if they need to. And, of course, we use the same empowering approach that we use throughout the service delivery. So we build on strengths. We are person-centered. We look for employability whenever possible to get people into jobs. And I think there's a strong interest to create community shelters throughout the city where this could happen, where a community like the Friendship Place community, but out in other neighborhoods, could help people this way.
Just a follow-up question. The mayor, this is the one kink in the armor so far, is that the mayor has asked landlords to step up to the plate and offer up their buildings to be part of this program, and so far very few takers. Only a couple of people have actually come forward, not nearly the amount of people they will need to actually use the small shelter model. So what can we do to do we need to offer more incentives, or what can we do to get landlords into this program?
Well, offering more incentives, I think, would work, of course, but we could also reach out to the faith community. This is how our shelters were started in the Friendship Place Network. The shelters are run by Metropolitan Church in Upper Northwest, St. Luke's, St. Paul's, and St. Columba's, and the movement activated 23 years ago when homelessness became such an issue and was so visible in the district, and our founders realized that in upper Northwest, there simply were no resources for people. And this community movement activated through the faith-based community and other members of the community, businesses, folks in the neighborhood who wanted to get involved, and was anchored in these congregations. So I think that a lot of congregations have land and space that they could use, and this might be a very viable option also.
Great.
Well, let me ask you a question. You know, it was recently reported that more than 26,000 units of housing had been produced without one affordable unit. And so what about exemptions in the inclusionary zoning laws that allow builders to produce new units with no affordable units? You know, in most cities, you can, like in New York, I think, you know, you can have, and it's still a small amount, but 80% of market value apartments, and then 20% have to be at an affordable rate. You know, how do we close that loophole so that it's kind of mandatory, or at least give enough incentives to the developers so that they will be willing to create affordable housing?
Well, some of this is being done, and I think we need more political support, probably from the council, the DC council. But the issue with that kind of affordable housing is that it is still in the range of affordable housing, essentially, and that what we need for the people we are serving at Friendship Place often is very, very affordable housing, if you want. So the affordable housing we keep hearing about in the press or in the media is housing that a teacher, a policeman, a fireman might be able to afford, if you want. But the people we are seeing are living way under the poverty line. Their family income is extremely low. And so we have to look at that, what this means for them.
And how about, I mean, I know the jobs are an important part of this, and I'd like to talk about that in a minute, but just how about minimum wage as a part of this? I mean, certainly this was a hot button issue during the campaign last year of raising the minimum wage. It's amazing to me that families are expected to survive in the District of Columbia on a minimum wage that produces $400 before taxes in the district a week. I don't know how you could live, support yourself on that, let alone support yourself and children on that amount of money. But that was a big issue in the campaign, and it really came to blows over Walmart. Walmart actually closed, stopped plans for two stores in the District of Columbia, and that was very controversial because you want the jobs, but you know, you need a decent wage. Don't we need to push for a higher minimum wage in the district?
Well, this is obviously a very sensitive issue, this issue with minimum wage. And yes, people do have to make a living that allows them to live properly. And of course, we need to keep, you know, looking at solutions in that direction too. It's very difficult to raise a family on some of the salaries that people are earning out there. So, and you know, when you throw in the question of affordability and the fact that people are losing ground every month, every year in the district, we really have to put all this together and look at the issue in a multifaceted way, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, as a politician, too, it seems to me that we want to keep people in the district, because when we keep them in the district, then they give us tax money back. So it's a win-win, I think, to raise the minimum wage. But that's just my little personal agenda.
Well, sorry, Jean-Michel, I wanted to ask you, like, how did you get involved involved. I mean, you have a great accent, by the way. So I gather you were not born in the United States. How did you come to get involved in this issue and run Friendship Place?
Well, I've been living in the States for 36 years. I'm French. I grew up in Grenoble and came over as a teenager and lived in California. I was living in New England by the time I got involved in the field. I started as a volunteer. I had friends who worked in the human services with people with intellectual disabilities. And then I was cross-trained in mental health and in mental health and addiction, so dual recovery, or it's also called co-occurring disorders. And I was running programs for a large nonprofit in Maryland, Alliance, when Friendship Place advertised. And when I came for my first interview in April of 2006 and I pushed the door of the center open and saw what was going on there, the folks who were rebuilding their lives, the way volunteers, participants, board members that day and staff all worked together to help people rebuild. It really pulled me in and I decided to get involved, and I'm delighted that I did. I think the field of homelessness is moving forward. We are probably the newest of the disciplines out there in human services, in that, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, we were looking at a hut and a cot, a hot meal and the cot you slept on. And then people said, well, let's add the services to help people rebuild better. And then we added permanent supportive housing with abstinence required, so no drugs, no alcohol. Then we went into housing first so we could be inclusive and very humane in the approach. And now the rapid solutions like rapid rehousing, prevention, job placement, employment first for us, are moving things forward not only in the D.C. area but in the entire country. And we see folks who tell us the same thing when we go present at conferences in different states now. We present our models. So it's very exciting in a way to be part of, you know, growing this movement, growing the field. And I became involved out of a desire, I think, to help. I'm a mental health and homelessness family member also. So that calling has always been there and very close to my heart.
Well, let me just say that you landed in the right place, Jean-Michel, because again, after visiting your operation, it seems to me that you and the people you employ are doing exactly what they should be doing in life, because you're doing such a great job at it. Really are. You're inspirational. But let me ask you, let's talk about education and job training for a minute. I know that's an important part of what you do. I know that job training is an important part of what you do. What about education? Do you put people in the pipeline to get GEDs or to go further in their education? And what kind of job training do we have available for people?
Well, as I mentioned, we're an employment-first program, so we work on soft skills training. We help people rehearse interviews. We work on resumes. We work on interview attire. We teach people how to apply for jobs electronically. And we move toward the placement, the job placement, as quickly as we can, so in an average of 60 days. But beyond that, when the person is on the job and in their own apartment, there's a possibility to come back to us so that we can refer folks to training programs for career advancement. So it's interesting that, you know, we are not primarily focusing on vocational training, which would require us to ask people to spend weeks or months with us getting trained at a time in their lives when they cannot afford to wait for their first paycheck. But that we have essentially reversed the order, job placement first, and then vocational additional training, be it vocational training, after. So that's the way we work.
Well, that sounds like a great way to do it. And do you coordinate with other government agencies throughout the city for things like getting people into GED programs and job training programs that are run through the Department of Employment Services and other things in the district?
Yes, absolutely. We have wonderful partners in the city offices. We work very closely with the Department of Human Services, with the Department of Employment Services as well, and other groups. We also work with many nonprofits. You really have to utilize the wider network in order to help people the right way. And you should not, of course, duplicate programs that are done extremely well across the city if they're there. Rather, you should, you know, have exchanges between organizations. We're also very, very fortunate to have built a very strong network of employers who have been very receptive throughout the region now that help us put people in jobs who have, from the GED or no GED level up to advanced degrees. We tap into the DC metro job market. So we need, of course, the service jobs. We need many of those, but we have placed people on K Street at IT desk. We placed a lawyer a couple of falls ago. And it's amazing to me to see how the team at Prince of Peace can do that with the help of these partners in the community, the employers, the other nonprofits, and the city offices. And then I really have to salute our amazing volunteers at Friendship Place. We have 28 volunteers who staff the program and show up every week. Some carry caseloads and some help us with job development contacts with employers.
Well, I can see that it's time for us to go. So I'm going to let Kathleen ask the last question. And I want to thank you, Jean-Michel. Please give your website one more time so that people that are out there looking to give money to a good cause, go to this website. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. Friendshipplace.org. And I said friendshipplacedc.org earlier in the middle there, and that works also. So please dial us and come and visit the website at friendshipplace.org. Two P's.
Well, Jean-Michel, thank you very much. You know, on Palm Sunday, it's kind of an inspiring subject to talk about because you can tell by the passion in your voice and the, you know, and the fact that you see a light at the end of the tunnel is very inspiring on this day. So I want to thank you very much for joining our show, and we'd love to have you back to talk about, you know, how you're doing and kind of talk more about the statistics and the type of people that, you know, I mean, I myself and Michael and I have talked about this a lot, that we see the middle class of older people, like people who we know in the 50s and 60s who've lost their job, you know, their age 50, 60. And so I'd like to come back and talk to you about just kind of what those people need to do and how to maybe find help for you all. So again, thank you so much for joining us back. And Michael, you want to sign off?
I just want to say, yes, we want to make sure, Jean-Michel, that the mayor not only talks the talk, but walks the walk. So maybe we'll have you back to talk about how she's doing in some time. And Kathleen, please stay out of states where people are in the Final Four, just to give them a chance. But thanks again, America, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it, and I'd love to come back.
Good, thank you.
Give the people their right to vote.